On stage, the band was smoking through an instrumental break. Reginald's son, Tidwell, strolled over to Sarah, feet ambling, hands a brown blur on the strings and frets of his guitar, and she turned to face him. They put their foreheads together, her laughing and him solemn. They looked into each other's eyes and tried to play each other down, the crowd cheering and clapping, the rest of the Red Tops laughing as they played. Seeing them together like that, I realized that I had been right. They were brother and sister. The resemblance was too strong to be missed or mistaken. But mostly, what I looked at was the way her hips and butt switched in that white dress. Kyra and I might be dressed in turn-of-the-century country clothes, but Sarah was thoroughly modern Millie. No bloomers for her, no petticoats, no cotton stockings. No one seemed to notice that she was wearing a dress that stopped above her knees, that she was all but naked by the standards of the time. And under Maddie's dress, she'd be wearing garments the like of which these people had never seen, a lycra bra and hip-hugger nylon panties. If I put my hands on her waist, the dress would slip not against an unwelcoming corset, but against soft, bare skin. Brown skin, not white. "What do you want, sugar?" Sarah backed away from Sun, shaking her ungirdled, unbustled fanny and laughing. He strolled back to his spot, and she turned to the crowd as the band played the turnaround. She sang the next verse, looking directly at me. "Before you start in fishing, you better check your line. Said before you start in fishing, honey, you better check on your line. I'll pull on yours, darling, and you best tug on mine." The crowd roared happily. In my arms, Kyra was shaking harder than ever. "I'm scared, Mike," she said. "I don't like that lady. She's a scary lady. She stole Maddie's dress. I want to go home." It was as if Sarah heard her, even over the rip and ram of the music. Her head cocked back on her neck, her lips peeled open, and she laughed at the sky. Her teeth were big and yellow. They looked like the teeth of a hungry animal. And I decided I agreed with Kyra. She was a scary lady. "Okay, hon," I murmured in Kai's ear. "We're out of here." But before I could move, the sense of the woman, I don't know how else to say it, fell upon me and held me. Now I understood what had shot past me in the kitchen to knock away the Carla Dean letters. The chill was the same. It was almost like identifying a person by the sound of their walk. She led the band to the turnaround once more, then into another verse. Not one you'd find in any written version of the song, though. "I ain't gonna hurt her, honey. Not for all the treasure in the world. Said I wouldn't hurt your baby, not for diamonds or for pearls. Only one black-hearted bastard dared to touch that little girl." The crowd roared as if it was the funniest thing they'd ever heard, but Kyra began to cry. Sarah saw this and stuck out her breasts, much bigger breasts than Maddie's, and shook them at her, laughing her trademark laugh as she did. There was a parodic coldness about this gesture, and an emptiness, too, a sadness. Yet I could feel no compassion for her. It was as if the heart had been burned out of her, and the sadness which remained was just another ghost, the memory of love haunting the bones of hate. And how her laughing teeth leered. Sarah raised her arms over her head, and this time shook it all the way down, as if reading my thoughts and mocking them, just like jelly on a plate, as some other old song of the time has it. Her shadow wavered on the canvas backdrop, which was a painting of Freiburg, and as I looked at it, I realized I had found the shape from my Manderley dreams. It was Sarah, of course. Sarah was the shape, and always had been. "No, Mike, that's close, but it's not right." Right or wrong, I'd had enough. I turned, putting my hand on the back of Kai's head and urging her face down against my chest. Both her arms were around my neck now, clutching with panicky tightness. I thought I'd have to bull my way back through the crowd. They had let me in easily enough, but they might be a lot less amenable to letting me back out. "Don't fuck with me, boys," I thought. "You don't want to do that." And they didn't. On stage, Son Tidwell had taken the band from E to G without a single pause. Someone began to bang a tambourine, and Sarah went from Fish and Blues to Dog My Cats without a single pause. Out here, in front of the stage and below it, the crowd once more drew back for me and my little girl, without looking at us or missing a beat as they clapped their work-swollen hands together. One young man with a port wine stain swimming across the side of his face opened his mouth. At 20, he was already missing half his teeth, and hollered, "Yee-haw!" around a melting glob of tobacco. It was Buddy Jellison from the Village Cafe, I realized. Buddy Jellison magically rolled back in age from 68 to 18. Then I realized the hair was the wrong shade, light brown instead of black. Although he was pushing 70 and looking it in every other way, Bud hadn't a single white hair in his head. This was Buddy's grandfather, maybe even his great-grandfather. I didn't give a shit either way. I only wanted to get out of here. "Excuse me," I said, brushing by him. "There's no town drunk here, you meddling son of a bitch," he said, never looking at me and never missing a beat as he clapped. "We all just take turns." It's a dream after all, I thought. It's a dream, and that proves it. But the smell of tobacco on his breath wasn't a dream. The smell of the crowd wasn't a dream. And the weight of the frightened child in my arms wasn't a dream either. My shirt was hot and wet where her face was pressed. She was crying. "Hey, Irish!" Sarah called from the stage, and her voice was so like Joe's that I could have screamed. She wanted me to turn back. I could feel her will working on the sides of my face like fingers, but I wouldn't do it. I dodged around three farmers who were passing a ceramic bottle from hand to hand, and then I was free of the crowd. The Midway lay ahead, wide as Fifth Avenue, and at the end of it was the arch, the steps, the street, the lake. Home. If I could get to the street, we'd be safe. I was sure of it. "Almost done, Irish!" Sarah shrieked after me. She sounded angry, but not too angry to laugh. "You gonna get what you want, sugar, all the comfort you need, but you wanna let me finish my business. Do you hear me, boy? Just stand clear. Mind me now." I began to hurry back the way I had come, stroking Kai's head, still holding her face against my shirt. Her straw hat fell off, but I didn't bother to pick it up. We had to get out of here. On our left was the baseball pitch, and some little kid shouting, "Johnny hit it over the fence, Ma! Johnny hit it over the fence!" with monotonous, brain-croggling regularity. We passed the bingo, where some woman howled that she had won the turkey, by glory. Every number was covered with a button, and she had won the turkey. Overhead, the sun dove behind a cloud, and the day went dull. Our shadows disappeared. The arch at the end of the Midway drew closer with maddening slowness. "Are we home yet?" Kai almost moaned. "I want to go home, Mike. Please take me home to my mommy." "I will," I said. "Everything's going to be all right." We were passing the Test Your Strength pole, where the young man with the red hair was putting his shirt back on. He looked at me with stolid dislike, the instinctive mistrust of a native for an interloper, perhaps. And I realized I knew him, too. He'd have a grandson named Dickie, who would, toward the end of the century to which this fair had been dedicated, own the all-purpose garage on Route 68. A woman coming out of the quilting booth stopped and pointed at me. At the same moment, her upper lip lifted in a dog snarl. I knew that face, too. From where? Somewhere around town. It didn't matter, and I didn't want to know, even if it did. "We never should have come here," Kai moaned. "Tell me about it," I said. "But I don't think we had any choice, hon. They came out of Freak Alley, perhaps 20 yards ahead. I saw them and stopped. There were seven in all, long, striding men dressed in cutter's clothes, but four didn't matter. Those four looked faded and white and ghostly. They were sick fellows, maybe dead fellows, and no more dangerous than daguerreotypes. The other three, though, were real. As real as the rest of this place, anyway. The leader was an old man wearing a faded blue Union Army cap. He looked at me with eyes I knew, eyes I had seen measuring me over the top of a snot-smeared oxygen mask. "Mike, why are we stopping?" "It's all right, Kai. Just keep your head down. This is all a dream. You'll wake up tomorrow morning in your own bed." "Kay." The jacks spread across the midway, hand to hand and boot to boot, blocking our way back to the arch and the street. Old Blue Cap was in the middle. The ones on either side of him were much younger, some by maybe as much as half a century. Two of the pale ones, the almost not there ones, were standing side by side to the old man's right, and I wondered if I could burst through that part of their line. I thought they were no more flesh than the thing which had thumped the insulation of the cellar wall, but what if I was wrong?
"Give her over, son," the old man said. His voice was reedy and implacable.
He held out his hands. It was Max DeVore. He had come back. Even in death, he was seeking custody. Yet it wasn't him. I knew it wasn't. The planes of this man's face were subtly different, the cheeks gaunter, the eyes a brighter blue. "Where am I?" I called to him, accenting the last word heavily, and in front of Angelina's booth, the man in the turban, a Hindu who perhaps hailed from Sandusky, Ohio, put down his flute and simply watched. The snake girls stopped dancing and watched too, slipping their arms around each other and drawing together for comfort. "Where am I, DeVore? If our great-grandfather shit in the same pit, then where am I?"
"Ain't here to answer your questions. Give her over."
"I'll take her, Jared," one of the younger men, one of those who was really there, said. He looked at DeVore with a kind of fawning eagerness that sickened me, mostly because I knew who he was, Bill Dean's father, a man who had grown up to be one of the most respected elders in Castle County, was all but licking DeVore's boots. "Don't think too badly of him," Joe whispered. "Don't think too badly of any of them. They were very young."
"You don't need to do nothing," DeVore said. His reedy voice was irritated. Fred Dean looked abashed. "He's going to hand her over on his own, and if he don't, we'll take her together."
I looked at the man on the far left, the third of those that seemed totally real, totally there. Was this me? It didn't look like me. There was something in the face that seemed familiar, but...
"Hand her over, Irish," DeVore said. "Last chance." "No."
DeVore nodded, as if this was exactly what he had expected.
"Then we'll take her. This has got to end. Come on, boys."
They started toward me, and as they did, I realized who the one on the end, the one in the caulked treewalker boots and flannel loggers pants, reminded me of. Kenny Oster, whose wolfhound would eat cake till it busted. Kenny Oster, whose baby brother had been drowned under the pump by Kenny's father. I looked behind me. The Red Tops were still playing, Sarah was still laughing, shaking her hips with her hands in the sky, and the crowd was still plugging the east end of the midway. That way was no good anyway. If I went that way, I'd end up raising a little girl in the early years of the 20th century, trying to make a living by writing penny dreadfuls and dime novels. That might not be so bad, but there was a lonely young woman miles and years from here who would miss her, who might even miss us both. I turned back and saw the Jack boys were almost on me, some of them more here than others, more vital, but all of them dead, all of them damned. I looked at the towhead whose descendants would include Kenny Oster and asked him, "What did you do? What in Christ's name did you men do?" He held out his hands. "Give her over, Irish. That's all you have to do. You and the woman can have more. All the more you want. She's young. She'll pop them out like watermelon seeds." I was hypnotized, and they would have taken us if not for Kyra. "What's happening?" she screamed against my shirt. "Something smells. Something smells so bad. Oh, Mike, make it stop." And I realized I could smell it, too. Spoiled meat and swamp gas, burst tissue and simmering guts. DeVore was the most alive of all of them, generating the same crude but powerful magnetism I had felt around his great-grandson, but he was as dead as the rest of them, too. As he neared, I could see the tiny bugs which were feeding in his nostrils and the pink corners of his eyes. "Everything down here is death," I thought. "Didn't my own wife tell me so?" They reached out their tenebrous hands, first to touch Kai and then to take her. I backed up a step, looked to my right, and saw more ghosts, some coming out of busted windows, some slipping from red brick chimneys. Holding Kyra in my arms, I ran for the ghost house.
"Get him!" Jared DeVore yelled, startled. "Get him, boys! Get that punk! God damn it!"
I sprinted up the wooden steps, vaguely aware of something soft rubbing against my cheek. Kai's little stuffed dog, still clutched in one of her hands. I wanted to look back and see how close they were getting, but I didn't dare. If I stumbled...
"Hey!"
the woman in the ticket booth cawed. She had clouds of red hair, makeup that appeared to have been applied with a garden trowel, and mercifully resembled no one I knew. She was just a carny, just passing through this benighted place. Lucky her.
"Hey, mister, you gotta buy a ticket."
"No time, lady, no time."
"Stop him," DeVore shouted. "He's a goddamn punk thief. That ain't his young'un he's got. Stop him."
But no one did, and I rushed into the darkness of the ghost house with Kai in my arms. Beyond the entry was a passage so narrow I had to turn sideways to get down it. Phosphorescent eyes glared at us in the gloom. Up ahead was a growing wooden rumble, a loose sound with a clacking chain beneath it. Behind us came the clumsy thunder of caulk-equipped logger's boots rushing up the stairs outside. The red-headed carny was hollering at them now. She was telling them that if they broke anything inside, they'd have to give up the goods.
"You mind me, you damned rubes," she shouted. "That place is for kids, not the likes of you."
The rumble was directly ahead of us. Something was turning. At first, I couldn't make out what it was.
"Put me down, Mike," Kyra sounded excited. "I want to go through by myself."
I set her on her feet, then looked nervously back over my shoulder. The bright light at the entryway was blocked out as they tried to cram in.
"You asses," DeVore yelled. "Not all at the same time. Sweet weeping Jesus."
There was a smack and someone cried out. I faced front just in time to see Kyra dart through the rolling barrel, holding her hands out for balance. Incredibly, she was laughing. I followed, got halfway across, then went down with a thump.
"Oops!"
Kyra called from the far side, then giggled as I tried to get up, fell again, and was tumbled all the way over. The bandana fell out of my bib pocket. A bag of whorehound candy dropped from another pocket. I tried to look back to see if they had gotten themselves sorted out and were coming. When I did, the barrel hurled me through another inadvertent somersault. Now I knew how clothes felt in a washing machine. I crawled to the end of the barrel, got up, took Kai's hand, and let her lead us deeper into the ghost house. We got perhaps 10 paces before white bloomed around her like a lily, and she screamed. Some animal, something that sounded like a huge cat, hissed heavily. Adrenaline dumped into my bloodstream, and I was about to jerk her backward into my arms again when the hiss came once more. I felt hot air on my ankles, and Kai's dress made that bell shape around her legs again. This time she laughed instead of screaming.
"Go, Kai," I whispered. "Fast."
We went on, leaving the steam vent behind. There was a mirrored corridor where we were reflected first as squat dwarves and then as scrawny ectomorphs with long white vampire features. I had to urge Kyra on again. She wanted to make faces at herself. Behind us, I heard cursing lumberjacks trying to negotiate the barrel. I could hear DeVore cursing, too, but he no longer seemed so, well, so imminent. There was a sliding pole that landed us on a big canvas pillow. This made a loud farting noise when we hit it, and Kai laughed until fresh tears spilled down her cheeks, rolling around and kicking her feet in glee. I got my hands under her arms and yanked her up.
"Don't tackle your own quarter, Mac," she said, then laughed again.
Her fear seemed to have entirely departed. We went down another narrow corridor. It smelled of the fragrant pine from which it had been constructed. Behind one of these walls, two ghosts were clanking chains as mechanically as men working on a shoe factory assembly line, talking about where they were going to take their girls tonight and who was going to bring some red-eye engine, whatever that was. I could no longer hear anyone behind us. Kyra led the way confidently, one of her little hands holding one of my big ones, pulling me along. When we came to a door painted with glowing flames and marked, "This way to Hades," she pushed through it with no hesitation at all. Here, red isinglass topped the passage like a tinted skylight, imparting a rosy glow I thought far too pleasant for Hades. We went on for what felt like a very long time, and I realized I could no longer hear the calliope, the hearty bong of the Test Your Strength bell, or Sarah and the Red Tops. Nor was that exactly surprising. We must have walked a quarter of a mile. How could any county fair ghost house be so big? We came to three doors then, one on the left, one on the right, and one set into the end of the corridor. On one, a little red tricycle was painted. On the door facing it was my green IBM typewriter. The picture on the door at the end looked older somehow, faded and dowdy. It showed a child's sled. "That's Scooter Larrabee's," I thought. "That's the one DeVore stole." A rash of goose flesh broke out on my arms and back. "Well," Kyra said brightly, "here are our toys." She lifted Strickland, presumably so he could see the red trike. "Yeah," I said, "I guess so." "Thank you for taking me away," she said. "Those were scary men, but the spooky house was fun. Nighty-night. Stricken says nighty-night, too." It still came out sounding exotic. "Tew," like the Vietnamese word for sublime happiness. Before I could say another word, she had pushed open the door with the trike on it and stepped through. It snapped shut behind her, and as it did, I saw the ribbon from her hat. It had come loose in the excitement and now lay in a little heap on the floor. I picked it up and tried the knob of the door she had just gone through. It wouldn't turn, and when I slapped my hand against the wood, it was like slapping some hard and fabulously dense metal. I stepped back, then cocked my head in the direction from which we'd come. There was nothing. Total silence. This is the between time, I thought. When people talk about slipping through the cracks, this is what they really mean. This is the place where they really go. "You better get going yourself," Joe told me. "If you don't want to find yourself trapped here, maybe forever, you better get going yourself." I tried the knob of the door with the typewriter painted on it. It turned easily. Behind this door was another narrow corridor, more wooden walls and the sweet smell of pine. I didn't want to go in there. Something about it made me think of a long coffin, but there was nothing else to do, nowhere else to go. I went, and the door slammed shut behind me. "Christ," I thought. "I'm in the dark, in a closed-in place. It's time for one of Michael Noonan's world-famous panic attacks." But no bands clamped themselves over my chest, and although my heart rate was high and my muscles were still jacked on adrenaline, I was under control. Also, I realized, it wasn't entirely dark. I could only see a little, but enough to make out the walls and the plank floor. I wrapped the dark blue ribbon from Kai's hat absently around my wrist, tucking one end underneath so it wouldn't come loose. Then I began to move forward. I went on for a long time, the corridor turning this way and that, seemingly at random. I felt like a microbe slipping through a wooden intestine. At last, I came to a pair of wooden arched doorways. I stood before them, wondering which was the correct choice, and realized I could hear Bunter's bell faintly through the one to my left. I went that way, and as I walked, the bell grew steadily louder. At some point, the sound of the bell was joined by the mutter of thunder. The autumn cool had left the air, and it was hot again, stifling. I looked down and saw the Dibbles and Clodhopper shoes were gone. I was wearing thermal underwear and itchy socks. Twice more I came to Choices, and each time I picked the opening through which I could hear Bunter's bell. As I stood before the second pair of doorways, I heard a voice somewhere in the dark say quite clearly, "No, the president's wife wasn't hit. That's his blood on her stockings." I walked on, then stopped when I realized my feet and ankles no longer itched, that my thighs were no longer sweating into the long johns. I was wearing the jockey shorts I usually slept in. I looked up and saw I was in my own living room, threading my way carefully around the furniture as you do in the dark, trying like hell not to stub your stupid toe. I could see a little better. Faint, milky light was coming in through the windows. I reached the counter which separates the living room from the kitchen and looked over it at the waggy cat clock. It was 5:05. I went to the sink and turned on the water. When I reached for a glass, I saw I was still wearing the ribbon from Kai's straw hat on my wrist. I unwound it and put it on the counter between the coffee maker and the kitchen TV. Then I drew myself some cold water, drank it down, and made my way cautiously along the north wing corridor by the pallid yellow glow of the bathroom nightlight. I peed. "You urinated," I could hear Kai saying, then went into the bedroom. The sheets were rumpled, but the bed didn't have the orgiastic look of the morning after my dream of Sarah, Maddie, and Joe. Why would it? I'd gotten out of it and had myself a little sleepwalk, an extraordinarily vivid dream of the Freiburg Fair. Except that was bullshit, and not just because I had the blue silk ribbon from Kai's hat. None of it had the quality of dreams on waking, where what seemed plausible becomes immediately ridiculous and all the colors, both those bright and those ominous, fade at once. I raised my hands to my face, cupped them over my nose, and breathed deeply. Pine. When I looked, I even saw a little smear of sap on one pinky finger. I sat on the bed, thought about dictating what I'd just experienced into the tape recorder, then flopped back on the pillows instead. I was too tired. Thunder rumbled. I closed my eyes, began to drift away, and then a scream ripped through the house. It was as sharp as the neck of a broken bottle. I sat up with a yell, clutching at my chest. It was Joe. I had never heard her scream like that in our life together, but I knew who it was just the same. "Stop hurting her!" I shouted into the darkness. "Whoever you are, stop hurting her!" She screamed again, as if something with a knife, clamp, or hot poker took a malicious delight in disobeying me. It seemed to come from a distance this time, and her third scream, while just as agonized as the first two, was further away still. They were diminishing as the little boy's sobbing had diminished. A fourth scream floated out of the dark. Then Sarah was silent. Breathless, the house breathed around me, alive in the heat, aware in the faint sound of dawn thunder. I was finally able to get into the zone, but couldn't do anything once I got there. I keep a steno pad handy for notes, character lists, page references, date chronologies, and I doodled in there a little bit, but the sheet of paper in the IBM remained blank. There was no thundering heartbeat, no throbbing eyes or difficulty breathing, no panic attack, in other words. But there was no story, either. Andy Drake, John Shackelford, Ray Garrity, the beautiful Regina Whiting, they stood with their backs turned, refusing to speak or move. The manuscript was sitting in its accustomed place on the left side of the typewriter, the pages held down with a pretty chunk of quartz I'd found on the lane. But nothing was happening. Zilch. I recognized an irony here, perhaps even a moral. For years I had fled the problems of the real world, escaping into various Narnias of my imagination. Now the real world had filled up with bewildering thickets. There were things with teeth in some of them, and the wardrobe was locked against me. Kyra, I had printed. putting her name inside a scalloped shape that was supposed to be a cabbage rose. Below it, I had drawn a piece of bread with a beret tipped rakishly on the top crust. Noonan's conception of French toast. The letters LB surrounded with curlicues. A shirt with a rudimentary duck on it. Beside this, I had printed quack, quack. Below quack, quack, I had written ought to fly away, bon voyage. At another spot on the sheet, I had written Dean, Auster, and DeVore. They were the ones who had seemed the most there, the most dangerous. Because they had descendants? But surely all seven of those Jacks mustn't they? In those days, most families were whoppers. And where had I been? I had asked, but DeVore hadn't wanted to say. It didn't feel any more like a dream at 9:30 on a sullenly hot Sunday morning, which left exactly what? Visions? Time travel? And if there was a purpose to such travel, what was it? What was the message, and who was trying to send it? I remembered clearly what I'd said just before passing from the dream in which I had sleepwalked out to Joe's studio and brought back my typewriter. I don't believe these lies, nor would I now. Until I could see at least some of the truth, it might be safer to believe nothing at all. At the top of the sheet upon which I was doodling, in heavily stroked letters, I printed the word DANGER, then circled it. From the circle, I drew an arrow to Kyra's name. From her name, I drew an arrow to ought to go away, bon voyage, and added Maddie. Below the bread wearing the beret, I drew a little telephone. Above it, I put a cartoon balloon with rrrring in it. As I finished this, the cordless phone rang. It was sitting on the deck rail. I circled Maddie and picked up the phone. Mike? She sounded excited, happy, relieved. Yeah, I said, how are you? Great, she said, and I circled LB on my pad. Lindy Briggs called 10 minutes ago. I just got off the phone with her. Mike, she's giving me my job back. Isn't that wonderful? Sure, and wonderful how it would keep her in town. I crossed out, ought to go away, bon voyage, knowing that Maddie wouldn't go. Not now. And how could I ask her to? I thought again, if only I knew a little more. Mike, are you... It's very wonderful, I said. In my mind's eye, I could see her standing in the kitchen, drawing the kinked telephone cord through her fingers, her legs long and coltish below her denim shorts. I could see the shirt she was wearing, a white tee with a yellow duck paddling across the front. I hope Lindy had the good grace to sound ashamed of herself. I circled the T-shirt I'd drawn. She did, and she was frank enough to kind of, well, disarm me. She said the Whitmore woman talked to her early last week. It was very frank and to the point, Lindy said. I was to be let go immediately. If that happened, the money, computer equipment, and software DeVore funneled into the library would keep coming. If it didn't, the flow of goods and money would stop immediately. She said she had to balance the good of the community against what she knew was wrong. She said it was one of the toughest decisions she ever had to make. Uh-huh. On the pad, my hand moved of its own volition, like a planchette gliding over a Ouija board, printing the words, please can't I please. There's probably some truth in it, but Maddie, how much do you suppose Lindy makes? I don't know. I bet it's more than any three other small-town librarians in the state of Maine combined. In the background, I heard Kai. Can I talk, Maddie? Can I talk to Mike? Please, can't I please? In a minute, hon. Then, to me, maybe. All I know is that I have my job back, and I'm willing to let bygones be bygones. On the page, I drew a book. Then I drew a series of interlocked circles between it and the duck T-shirt. Kai wants to talk to you, Maddie said, laughing. She says the two of you went to the Freiburg Fair last night. Whoa, you mean I had a date with a pretty girl and slept through it? Seems that way. Are you ready for her? Ready. Okay, here comes the chatterbox. There was a rustling as the phone changed hands, then Kai was there. I tackled you at the fair, Mike.
I tackled my own quarterback. Did you? I asked. That was quite a dream, wasn't it, Kai? There was a long silence at the other end. I could imagine Maddie wondering what had happened to her telephone chatterbox. At last, Kai said in a hesitating voice, "You there, Tew."
Tew.
"We saw the snake dance ladies, the pole with the bell on top. We went in the spooky house.
You fell down in the barrel."
"It wasn't a dream, was it?"
I could have convinced her that it was, but all at once that seemed like a bad idea, one that was dangerous in its own way. I said, "You had on a pretty hat and a pretty dress."
"Yeah." Kai sounded enormously relieved. "And you had on..."
Kyra, stop. Listen to me. She stopped at once. "It's better if you don't talk about that dream too much, I think. To your mom, or to anyone except me."
"Except you?"
"Yes. And the same with the refrigerator people, okay?"
"Okay. Mike, there was a lady in Maddie's clothes."
"I know," I said. It was all right for her to talk, I was sure of it, but I asked anyway.
"Where's Maddie now?"
"Watering the flowers. We got lots of flowers, a billion at least. I have to clean up the table. It's a chore."
"I don't mind, though. I like chores. We had French toast. We always do on Sundays. It's yummy, especially with strawberry syrup."
"I know," I said, drawing an arrow to the piece of bread wearing the beret. "French toast is great. Kai, did you tell your mom about the lady in her dress?"
"No, I thought it might scare her."
She dropped her voice.
"Here she comes."
"That's all right, but we've got a secret, right?"
"Yes."
"Now can I talk to Maddie again?"
"Okay."
Her voice moved off a little. "Mommy, Bommy, Mike wants to talk to you." Then she came back. "Will you visit us today? We could go on another picnic."
"I can't today, Kai. I have to work."
"Maddie never works on Sunday." "Well, when I'm writing a book, I write every day. I have to, or else I'll forget the story. Maybe we'll have a picnic on Tuesday, though. A barbecue picnic at your house."
"Is it long till Tuesday?"
"Not too long. Day after tomorrow."
"Is it long to write a book?"
"Medium long."
I could hear Maddie telling Kai to give her the phone.
"I will. Just one more second. Mike?"
"I'm here, Kai.
I love you."
I was both touched and terrified. For a moment, I was sure my throat was going to lock up the way my chest used to when I tried to write. Then it cleared, and I said, "Love you too, Kai. Here's Maddie."
Again, there was the rustly sound of the telephone changing hands. Then Maddie said, "Did that refresh your recollection of your date with my daughter, sir?"
"Well," I said, "it certainly refreshed hers."
There was a link between Maddie and I, but it didn't extend to this. I was sure of it. She was laughing. I loved the way she sounded this morning, and I didn't want to bring her down. But I didn't want her mistaking the white line in the middle of the road for the cross mark, either.
"Maddie, you still need to be careful, okay? Just because Lindy Briggs offered you your old job back doesn't mean everyone in town is suddenly your friend."
"I understand that," she said. I thought again about asking if she'd consider taking Kai up to Derry for a while. They can live in my house, stay for the duration of the summer, if that was what it took for things to return to normal down here. Except she wouldn't do it. When it came to accepting my offer of high-priced New York legal talent, she'd had no choice. About this, she did, or thought she did, and how could I change her mind? I had no logic, no connected facts. All I had was a vague, dark shape, like something lying beneath 9 inches of snow-blind ice. "I want you to be careful of two men in particular," I said. "One is Bill Dean. The other is Kenny Oster. He's the one with the big dog who wears the neckerchief. He..."
"That's Booberry," Kai called from the middle distance. "Booberry licked my facey."
"Go out and play, hon," Maddie said.
"I'm clearing the table."
"You can finish later. Go on outside now."
There was a pause as she watched Kai go out the door, taking Strickland with her.
Although the kid had left the trailer, Maddie still spoke in the lowered tone of someone who doesn't want to be overheard. "Are you trying to scare me?"
"No," I said, drawing repeated circles around the word
danger. But I want you to be careful. Bill and Kenny may have been on DeVore's team, like Footman and Osgood. Don't ask me why I think that might be, because I have no satisfactory answer. It's only a feeling, but since I got back on the TR, my feelings are different. What do you mean? Are you wearing a T-shirt with a duck on it? How do you know that? Did Kai tell you? Did she take the little stuffed dog from her Happy Meal out with her just now? A long pause. At last, Maddie said, "My God," in a voice so low I could hardly hear it. Then again, "How? I don't know how. I don't know if you're still in a bad situation either, or why you might be, but I feel that you are, that you both are." I could have said more, but I was afraid she'd think I'd gone entirely off the rails. "He's dead," she burst out. "That old man is dead. Why can't he leave us alone?" Maybe he has. Maybe I'm wrong about all this, but there's no harm in being careful, is there? "No," she said. "Usually that's true."
"Usually?"
"Why don't you come and see me, Mike? Maybe we could go to the fair together."
"Maybe this fall we will. All three of us. I'd like that.
In the meantime, I'm thinking about the key." "Thinking is half your problem, Mike," she said and laughed again. Ruefully, I thought. And I saw what she meant. What she didn't seem to understand was that feeling was the other half. It's a sling, and in the end, I think it rocks most of us to death.